You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Everybody, welcome to the Paranormal Portal podcast. I hope you guys are having a wonderful night, and thank you so much for tuning in and supporting all that we're doing here on the podcast. It's been amazing. You guys have been amazing out there checking us out and subscribing and downloading, and it's just a real pleasure. Of course, I'm your host, Brent Thomas. This is the Paranormal Portal podcast, and once again, special thanks to Revolver Podcast for making all this possible.
Hey all, this is Don with Paranormal Portal. As I promised last week, it is the new Wednesday edition of the Paranormal Portal podcast. And today we are presenting the second part of The Real Roswell with Don Schmidt. This is the second part, and he's going to pick up right where he left off with the story of Mac Brazel and the collecting of all the artifacts left from the Roswell crash. So here we go. Let's jump into this, and I hope you enjoy it.
Of course, Mr. Donald Schmidt is joining us, and he is educating the hell out of me personally. It's been a great show, great talk. You know, it's just one of these rare opportunities to just finally peer through the curtain with a little bit of certainty, finally, that, you know, brushing aside all of the obfuscation, all of the debris that was thrown into the way of the truth, and now we can get a little, debris, I guess. I didn't mean it that way, but that was, you know, now we can get to something.
You know, even back at the time of the incident, the Army was claiming that they had recovered balloon devices all around Roswell at that time, suggesting that there were all types of false reports that people, because the whole flying saucer and flying disc enigma had just originated within the 2 weeks leading up to Roswell and that summer of 1947 wave. And then even after the balloon press conference where they explained it all away, they staged events for the media all over the country, demonstrating that, well, you see that once this balloon is airborne at 10,000 feet and with the air pressure at that elevation, that it compresses the balloon and it makes an ellipsoid, and then the sun reflects off of it. You see how maybe people might mistake that for being a flying saucer. And nobody ever asked the question, well, what about when it's on the ground in front of you and you can actually hold it?
Yeah.
Right. In reference to Roswell. And so, again, it was a case of where the military says this is what it is. We accept it as gospel.
Sure.
Post-World War II, it was just that simple. But, again, I'm going to ask your audience to just step into the situation for the moment and then ask themselves. I was talking about the military actually abducting civilians, holding on to them to prevent them from telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And the main example would have been the very ranch foreman, W.W. Mack Brazel, who started the whole thing. And he was not only abducted by the Roswell Army Airfield, so was the wire recording where he discussed and described at length the bodies that he discovered a couple miles from the debris field. Mm. So much for First Amendment rights, because it was at the time in the possession of the majority owner of radio station KGFL, Walt Whitmore Sr. So much for depriving him of, you know, the First Amendment rights that I like to believe we have intact today. Mm-hmm. So anyway, now just imagine if you're Mack Brazel, and then after you're released by the military, you're able to go back to your ranch and back to your duties as the foreman on that ranch, and you're a changed man. You don't want to talk about it. You don't want to hear about it. Even your own family, you tell them it's better you don't ever know about it. It'll ruin your lives. And then it eventually comes out that they kept me up all hours of the night. They deprived me of food and water. Mm-hmm. They asked me the same questions over and over again until I couldn't take it any longer. Mm-hmm. And then the indignity, the embarrassment when I was subjected to a full army physical and a full body cavity search.
Oh, geez.
Looking for pieces of a weather balloon? Yeah. Are we?
Yeah.
And, oh, he's lying. He's lying. That's all the skeptics can say. He's lying. Mm-hmm. But the point is, why would you admit something like that in public?
Right.
Of all things. For the publicity? Oh, well, are you going to sue them? Well, there was no action taken. You know, they did not even provide Brazel with due process. They didn't even allow him to call his own wife, call his boss. He's away from his duties as the foreman on the ranch. They didn't allow him to make a phone call.
Wow.
Again, over a weather balloon.
Hmm.
And so, you know, these are all things that I step away and I keep thinking back. You place yourselves in their shoes. And then it keeps begging the bigger question. What were they so concerned about unless it was exactly what the eyewitnesses were reporting? Right. Something that extraordinary.
Yeah.
There was nothing in the Army field manual. You know, where's that chapter? Recovery of a spaceship. What do we do next? That type of thing. So they were going through the motions. They did what they had to do. They were following orders.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they treated the civilians in a manner that just to this day, you look back and you finally come to the conclusion that I can't find anything else that matches this. I can't find a single example involving the recovery of a weather balloon device that they treated the participants in this manner. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't care. For example, when that F-117, that stealth fighter, crashed south of Holloman Air Force Base, close to the Texas state line, and the pilot was picked up hitchhiking back to Holloman Air Force Base. They later would claim that the aircraft actually crashed to the east, close to the Texas-New Mexican state line. So they diverted attention completely away from the area.
Mm.
They truly had something that was top secret. The materials, as far as the very stealth technology, is still classified top secret. And, you know, we looked into that, and we could not find, for all the civilians who were involved, a single example of where they were threatened, where they were intimidated, or especially where they were abducted,
right,
because they might have in their possession a piece of the aircraft.
Mm, good point.
And so we looked into, when a Blackbird, an SR-71, crashed, and they came up with the explanation that it was a commercial, albeit zero passenger, Republic airliner that crashed in Missouri, and in reality, it was a Blackbird back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And again, there were no witnesses that talked about any such tactics that were used to silence them at the time. But we keep coming back to Roswell. Why was this the exception?
Mm-hmm.
So it keeps pointing, it keeps coming back to something so high on the scale that they were forced to do all they could to ensure the fact that they had time to get some answers. Because, first of all, you don't know if this is a vanguard of an approaching invasion.
Right.
You don't know if it's something that's toxic to, you know, the human race.
Sure.
Given, you know, its origins, that type of thing. And so it's all you can do to contain it and make sure that you have some stall time, some time to come up with some rational solutions and then determine what's your next move, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are 72 years later, and the government is now officially up to 4 explanations regarding this one event. 4 explanations. And I always joke, you know, when I lecture that especially the men should try that with their wives when they get home too late. You know, you don't like this one, honey, try this one. But that's exactly, we allow the government to do it.
Yeah.
But it still comes down to which explanation of the 4 do not just the majority, but in the case of Roswell, do all the witnesses still endorse, still subscribe to, still state is the only legitimate explanation? And that's the first one, the flying saucer.
Right.
That it was a craft of unknown origin that was not of the earth, that there were bodies covered of little people, little men. And as one of the personnel who was stationed at Roswell in 1947, when he was asked by CBS reporter Phil Jones, when we did a piece for CBS 48 Hours, he was asked, well, how do you know they weren't from here? To which he responded, well, they sure weren't from Texas.
Right.
So again, you know, visually, you know, you just keep coming back to, they're talking of this super strong material. They're talking about multiple sites. They're talking about memory material. They're talking about little people that weren't from here, that weren't human. And again, it paints this mosaic. It creates this picture well beyond any type of balloon. And it certainly then covers the full gamut of every alternative. And we have looked at every alternative explanation. Believe me, we even looked into the possibility of a Japanese atomic bomb.
Okay.
And just covering all of our bases. And nothing need apply. Nothing comes close.
No, what happened to the bodies or the survivor and the bodies, as far as you know?
Everything went. In fact, it's also a matter of historic fact.
Okay.
Everything went to Wright Field, which would become Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio.
Right.
In fact, we have dozens of witnesses who were on the receiving end, who were there at the time, and then were involved with the testing, the analysis of the wreckage,
mm-hmm.
and then even doctors who were involved with the autopsies performed on the remains. And then we even have the survivor being at Wright-Patterson We have the testimony of Colonel Marion Magruder, who was part of the War College, class of 47-48. And in 1995, before he died, he confessed to five of his sons that they were taken, they were on assignment at Wright-Patterson, and they were shown the wreckage from Roswell. And then they were taken to another room, and there they saw the survivor. We documented the fact that Magruder was assigned at Wright-Patterson in April of 1948. So immediately after the incident, within a year. So that's, again, part of the chain of events, the chronology, even beyond the summer of 1947, that we are able to still plug in specific experiences involving keynote witnesses who describe very crucial elements of the entire case. So the balloon story swept this all away. You know, the press release goes out at noon Central Standard Time on Tuesday, July 8th. Ladies and gentlemen, we captured a flying saucer.
Yeah.
5 hours later, it's all explained away as just a weather balloon with a radar reflector kite. End of story as far as the press and the public are concerned. But the recovery operation is still in high gear. The retrieval at the crash site, the retrieval of the craft and the bodies, and then all the special flights transporting all the physical evidence out of Roswell, all ensues, you know, within days after that weather balloon story. So all the activity just doesn't come to an abrupt end because it's nothing more than a balloon. In fact, most of the recovery operation is still yet to take place when the people and the press have washed their hands of it, and there's nothing more to see here, nothing to see here.
And I would bet that that's probably when a lot of their real serious efforts went into play, so nobody was watching anymore. So
precisely, you could not be as far as more accurate. In other words, it was the old shell game. Mm-hmm. While you're all looking over here, now we can focus on, you know, the issues at hand.
Yeah. What an amazing magic trick, really. I mean, it was just sleight of hand. Yeah, it's totally sleight of hand. I don't think your mic is working. Sorry about that. We have technical difficulties in the studio once in a while. I think it's the static generated by Don's beard that hotwires his microphone or something. But so all of these things have continued. And is there any leaking on YouTube, for instance? You can see every once in a while the video of the alien survivor in Area 51. Have you seen any of those? And do you have any opinion of those?
It's an alien Muppet.
Okay.
Nothing genuine about it. I'm surprised how many people fell for it. But see, the difference with us, and I'll address a few of the other examples in a moment, but 99.9% of all UFO events are fleeting events, fleeting experiences. Now you see it, now you don't. Dr. Hynek used to talk about the Cheshire Cat effect from Alice in Wonderland, that the cat disappears and all you have left then is the grin, the smile. And so with almost every other UFO experience, all you have left is the impression, the image in your mind. And in some rare cases, you have photographs, some video. Most of those are explained away, so the number of legitimate UFO or UFO photographs around the world probably number in the dozens, and not much beyond that. So nonetheless, it's all, again, reliant on eyewitness testimony. You have some good solid radar cases.
Sure.
Have multiple witness cases. We have last count over 3,000 UFO landing cases where there is a physical interaction with the environment, a compressed ground, swirled grass, depressions, you know, from landing gear, even some metal slag fragments at times, a physiological effect on witnesses, conjunctivitis, even radiation burns on witnesses, that type of thing. But we don't have the genuine article. We don't have the actual UFO.
Right.
With Roswell, if, again, this is a genuine event, we have it. We have it in our possession.
Yeah.
So not only are we talking about an attack craft, not only are we talking about thousands of pieces of fragments, of pieces of wreckage, not only are we talking about physical remains, biological remains, and certainly you would preserve unique specimens of that sort. You wouldn't just toss them away at some point. And then you talk about all the documentation. Then you talk about all the sworn affidavits and all the depositions. Then you talk about all the photographs and all the film. And then you talk about the autopsies. And then you talk about all the photograph and film regarding that situation. So you're talking about just an unlimited amount of evidence, all involving one event. And very few other UFO events, you know, rise to that level.
Right.
A possible breakthrough all in one fell swoop. Roswell encompasses everything.
Mm-hmm.
One event, everything. So through the years, God knows we have had dozens of false flags. We have had photographs. We have had slides. We have had fragments of metal. We have had false witnesses. We have had, as far as false locations, crawl spaces, caves, attics, basements behind retaining walls. But the point being, you still have to check out every one because all it's going to take is that one. Because if you accept that the case already has risen to that level, anything that may appear linked, any little crumb, any little trace of that full event is potentially enough to solve this, to break this. So you do have to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I can honestly say we have never turned a deaf ear. We will interview every possible witness. We have checked out every possible physical piece of evidence with that hope and with that possibility that all it's going to take is one time. So we've had all these false alarms. We've checked out everything and anything, and we will continue to. But to suggest that just because there have been a lot of phony examples of possible physical evidence and witnesses, you mentioned as far as like on YouTube and witnesses that have stepped forward. And let me tell you that typically is the first giveaway. When they come forward, when they're seeking publicity,
right,
notoriety. Hey, you forgot about me. Because invariably, the legitimate... Now, we have interviewed over 600 witnesses who were either directly or indirectly involved with the events of 1947 up to the present. And as a result, these are all people that we had to track down, or we received leads from other witnesses who would suggest, well, you need to talk to so-and-so, or I recall so-and-so who was in the hangar, or so-and-so who was on the flight, that type of thing. And then you still need to track them down. And nonetheless, invariably, they've been reluctant. Their typical reaction is, how did you find me? I have nothing to say. I wasn't there. I wasn't involved. You have the wrong person.
Wow.
And then you have to slowly gain their confidence.
Mm-hmm.
All smacking of the fact that they want nothing to do with this. They took an oath, or they were silenced by fright, by threats, by intimidation. We'll never talk about this again. And they believe it. That to this day, I mean, they still, you know, I'm not talking about this. So what you typically have on the internet, on social media, if they're coming out of the woodwork and acknowledging that, or that they become whistleblowers, chances are they're blowing up everyone's, you know, where, because it's not legitimate.
Okay.
Not true. It's not true.
I gotcha.
And so these are the ones that, if you ask me, and I'm often asked, well, what about so-and-so? What about Officer so-and-so? What about the CIA agent who came forward and claimed, and I remember that whole fiasco. And I said, the very fact that they were able to talk about something that sensitive and not be in any jeopardy, not have, as far as face any reprisal, any as far as penalty for breaking their oath of security. I always cite the example of Edward Snowden, whether you believe him to be a hero, a traitor. Nonetheless, he still had to flee the country.
Right. Yeah.
And who would have predicted 20 years ago we'd have to go to Russia for asylum? But nonetheless, that's what happened.
It is.
Now, so if I'm a true whistleblower releasing information about Area 51, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Roswell incident, and I'm telling the truth, you better believe it. I'm going to be in a lot of trouble.
You better run.
You better run. Yeah. And you better, you know, make sure it's on a quick plane as far as overseas.
So don't go away, everybody. We'll be right back for more of Mr. Donald Schmidt and the Mysteries of Roswell.
Welcome back, one and all, to the Paranormal Portal, the last half hour. We've had a great show. It's rushed right by, as they usually do when we have great guests and great discussions. And we really appreciate our guest tonight. That would be Mr. Don Schmidt. How you doing over there? You doing all right, Don?
I'm great.
Excellent. So, you know, we've been talking about Roswell, the grandpappy of them all. You know, I kind of wanted to ask a question. I kind of wanted to lead kind of towards Wright-Patterson. And, you know, let me put it this way. Everybody, you know, there's this whole September 20th thing coming up about, oh, they can't catch us all, or, you know, like they're Pokemon, or they can't something us all. Anyhow, but, you know, why, I mean, even I knew when I was a kid, back in the 80s, the late 70s, early 80s, and I'm in high school, and I'm like, they didn't take it to Area 51. They took it to Wright-Patterson. You're going to the wrong spot. So what, I mean, it's all out there. Everybody knows this. Why? What it would be their thinking of storming Area 51 instead of Wright-Patterson, where the things are, where these things are?
Oh, they were. In fact, there's a full-bird colonel who actually admitted to us on one occasion that, he said it became the damnedest thing, as he put it, to try to hide things in the middle of a city. We had a hell of a time, he said, moving things in and moving things out, because Wright-Patterson is right in the heart of Dayton.
Right.
Whereas a lot of the other facilities are on the side of a mountain, out in the middle of the desert, as remote as one would anticipate, especially with the advent of satellite tracking technology, especially after Sputnik, all these SAC strategic air commands, they started to go underground. Wright Patt was no different. You know, we've heard as many as 10 levels beneath the surface.
Right.
And so it's our information that just about everything sensitive was moved out of Wright Patt in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. So did it all go to Area 51? Well, no, we believe it went to other facilities. But because 51 has been so glamorized,
right,
especially in TV and in the movies, and first of all, 51 did not even exist back in 1947.
Right.
It actually wasn't even, it was just a runway for some experimental aircraft. They just used it as a backup runway. That was really it. And it wasn't until 55 that it was officially, you know, established as a working facility. And as we know too, it wasn't even really officially acknowledged till during the Clinton administration that even such a base even existed. So they did much themselves to fuel the whole notion that don't look at the man behind the curtain type of thing.
Yeah.
And so, but they were also playing up the idea that, well, maybe there is more going on here. So I think they were having fun with it.
Okay.
And now they realize that it now may finally get out of control and somebody might get hurt.
Right.
And what they need to do, and I'm surprised they have not done it. They still have over a month. But that they need to put out basically a warning, a statement that this is what we will do. Mm-hmm. We will not, basically, we will not take hostages. You know, that we will take this as an invasion, as a threat to, you know, our national security. It still comes back to national security has no concern for civil rights.
No.
They do not, you know, they do not come together in any shape, manner, or form. And so I will expect nothing less from, you know, the military, making the point abundantly clear. But in the meantime, they have done much of this to themselves because I think they just love, I think they secretly, they get off on the idea that, yeah, people think we have alien hardware here. Yeah, they think we're flying actual, you know, spacecraft, you know, from another planet. Mm-hmm. And I think they're relishing the notion that, well, maybe not now, but someday. Mm. And so it's all a bit of a precursor of what they envision, what they, and, you know, even the very name Dreamland. you know, plays into that. So, you know, welcome to my world, because I think the Air Force, I think they owe us, those of us who have always downplayed 51.
Right.
I mean, even the very name, it's just, it happens to be on that grid. It just happens to be because there's also Area 50 and 52 and 53, just happens to be that particular parcel.
Yeah.
But back in the late 90s, when there was a class action suit of a lot of former employees at the base, and they would describe that everything was coming on to the grounds and nothing was leaving.
Right.
And that it became more and more of a concern because they would pile up all this used material and they would just douse it with aviation fuel and they'd burn it every so often, just destroy it. Well, a lot of this obviously was leaching into the ground and into the water and obviously into the air. And so there was a growing concern because some of these people were getting sick. Some of these people were even prematurely dying. And so what were they exposed to?
Yeah.
So for a number of years, 51 was actually somewhat dismantled. It was inactive. And so a lot of activity, a lot of, concern then was devoted to Area 52, which is in Utah. And during all of the rocket experiments with the captured German V-2s after World War II at the White Sands Proving Ground, well, where were they launching? What was their target? Well, it was to this facility, this proving ground in Utah, which would eventually become Dugway Air Force Base, Area 52. And Dugway, nonetheless, is the headquarters of the Military Biological Medical Research Facility. So get that name, Biological Medical Research Facility. So we have a firsthand, again, full bird colonel who was stationed at Dugway in the late 50s and saw one of the bodies. Can't tell you it was from Roswell. I can't tell you exactly as far as the recovery site of how it happened to fall into the possession of Dugway at that time. But nonetheless, he signed an affidavit. He swore to the fact that he saw a non-human body at Dugway in 1959. So then we add the late Colonel George Weinbrenner, who was at Wright-Patterson. He was head of the Foreign Technology Division. Well, my scientific director, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, Weinbrenner was his boss after Project Blue Book from 1970 through 1973. He answered to Weinbrenner. Foreign Technology, formerly T2, which was intelligence at Wright Field, handled all the wreckage and the remains that came from Roswell. They did all the attempts at reverse engineering. T2/FTD, Foreign Technology Division, if they got their hands on a German Messerschmitt 262 or a Russian MiG, that's where it went, where they would tear it down and see what made it tick. So it made perfect sense that if you had something of foreign design or something of truly foreign design, it went to, right, Pat, it went to Foreign Technology. Well, Weinbrenner, he's the head of Foreign Technology. He retires to San Antonio, and before he dies, he sends a message to Robert Emmenegger, who was the author of the book UFOs, Past, Present, and Future. Emmenegger is a documentary producer. He had been contracted by the Air Force in the mid-1970s to produce a film on UFOs as sponsored by the United States Air Force. And who was his contact man at Wright-Patterson? Colonel George Weinbrenner. Well, it never did get off the ground. The Air Force placed too many stipulations. There were too many restrictions as to what they could display, what they could provide, what they could present. Never happened. Well, nonetheless, Weinbrenner, before he died, he sends word, he sends a message to Emmenegger, which stated simply, Bob, we have five bodies at Dugway. Oh. Wow. Let me get this more precise. We have five bodies in Utah. We have five bodies in Utah.
Oh my God.
Okay. So, and that obviously meant, we have five bodies from somewhere else.
Right.
At Dugway. So then the second last director of Project Blue Book, Colonel Robert Trent. Last time I had dinner with him in Los Angeles, and Friend, who as a good Air Force intelligence officer, former head of Blue Book, talks in circles. You can't pin him down. And no matter how I tried to get him to acknowledge and admit certain things, and I cracked the door a number of times, and then he would just smile at me because he knew.
He knew.
Yeah. What he wasn't telling me was still everything.
Yeah.
So I asked him, hypothetically, I know you aren't going to admit anything, but hypothetically, Colonel, if you had bodies, if you had non-human bodies, where would they be today? And without hesitating, he goes, why? Of course, Dugway, medical research facility. So, Area 52.
Yep.
Wow. Now, I got to ask you, we only have about 12 minutes left, but of course, it seems like the Navy's taken a different approach and has been releasing some, you know, I guess they're ambiguous videos, but they seem to demonstrate some kind of otherworldly craft.
Yes.
What is your position on that, knowing what you know about how the Air Force has conducted this whole Roswell cover-up? What do you think is going on here?
Well, as you did describe, though, this is the Navy, not the Air Force.
Right.
And,
that's true.
There's nothing. I mean, when you think the deception, the cover-up perpetrated by the United States Air Force for 72 years, how do they all of a sudden come clean? All of a sudden now, well, now you can trust us? Now you can believe us?
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, they've dug themselves so deep that I find it it's irrecoverable. I mean, there's just absolutely no way that they could ever, short of actually displaying the craft and the bodies.
Right.
And then half the people would still discount it. But we need to keep in mind that when the Air Force came out in September of 1994 with their Project Mogul report, explanation number 3, mm-hmm. And Colonel Richard Weaver at the Pentagon, you know, he admitted over and over again that we lied about the balloon explanation in July of 1947 about Roswell. We were forced to lie. And then he came out and he kept using the word theory. They were presenting their new theory. And it's the same off-the-shelf material balloon. But what confused the personnel in charge of the atomic bomb back in 47 was not the balloon, but the microphone, the acoustic listening device that Mogul, you know, involved. The theory being that at high altitude, that when the Soviet Union would detonate their first atomic bomb, we'd pick up the shock wave in the upper atmosphere. Well, the project failed miserably. It didn't work.
Mm.
And nonetheless, it suggests that, well, they saw this microphone laying there amidst all the balloon wreckage, and they went, oh, my God, we're being invaded. Sorry, again, it just stretches credulity as far as all hope.
Yeah.
Well, nonetheless, Sheila Windhall was the Secretary of the Air Force at that time. So when the Mogul report came out, she issued a statement that they were relieving all Air Force personnel of their security oaths regarding Roswell.
Mm.
And there wasn't a historian in the room, or at least there wasn't a reporter in the room that didn't catch the red herring that had just been released. There was no Air Force in July of 1947.
Nope.
This was an Army incident. How does the Air Force absolve the Army of a security oath? Sorry, you know, no cigar. So again, they were lying to us. They were trying to trick us. And only we picked up on it. And so when the Air Force Project Blue Book was declassified in 1977, 13,000 cases the Air Force investigated. 701 remained unexplained.
Oh.
So much for their explaining everything.
Right.
701 officially unexplained. And we're going, where are all the Army cases? Where are all the Navy cases?
Sure.
It's all Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're just a smattering here and there, or just a reference to this naval incident or this army case. But I mean, certainly there had to be hundreds, possibly thousands of Navy and Army. Where were all those cases? Well, it doesn't take a genius to realize they have their own investigations.
Sure. Right.
And so they remain intact. They still remain classified. So now the Navy, I would love to believe that they finally are getting to the point that, well, our record is clean. And maybe we need to slowly start testing the waters, and maybe we're going to slowly start putting out some crumbs to see how the public responds. And we're going to be the vanguards, finally releasing the truth about the UFO phenomena, that we are not alone.
Yeah.
Now, lest the audience think that, well, you know, that, well, the one branch of the military, you know, certainly consorts with the others. Oh, no, they don't. They're all in competition with one another. Mm-hmm. And the best example would be even Desert Storm and the late general, Norman Schwarzkopf, of the Army, and he was having his daily briefings, and he was complaining that the very first night that they raided, that they attacked Baghdad in Desert Storm, and the Air Force immediately declared air supremacy. Well, the Army didn't know if it was clear for them to march into downtown Baghdad or not, because the Air Force wasn't telling them anything. Wow. And the same with the Navy, still launching, you know, their cruise missiles into the city. Oh. We had the Army had no idea, because they were not on the same page. They didn't have the same playbook. So clearly it demonstrated that they still are their own separate entities. They are not cooperating. They are not working together. And as evidenced by the Air Force Project Blue Book, they were not investigating the phenomenon in the cooperation of the Navy and the Army and the other branches.
Wow.
So I would love for the Navy to now finally say, enough is enough.
Right.
You know, I think that's pretty...
Our pilots are experiencing these objects. They are beyond anything that... And heaven help us if they're Russian or Chinese. And secondly, they're defying the laws of physics as we know them.
Right.
And if that's the case, then we're dealing with an intelligence way beyond our own.
Right.
So it's exciting times.
Yeah.
But we have to remain cautious yet optimistic, because the press, the 24-hour, you know, cycle of the media,
right,
they quickly move on.
Yeah, they do.
And they will move on. The next shoe has to drop. And if we wait too long, again, the UFO field, we don't have the answers. We're waiting now for more information, you know, to come forward. And we just hope it's before the water turns cold.
Right, right. Hey, Don, we've got just a couple minutes left. So in 1 minute, could you tell me what you think? Do you think that the Navy is actually going for disclosure?
No, and for this reason. Because who still owns the purse strings? And in fact, when... The Congress people, and I could name the 10 who are involved,
mm-hmm,
who are being briefed, and the president has acknowledged that he's also being briefed on the situation, and this is by the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it still comes down to, unfortunately, the politicians saying, well, we don't believe this should be publicized. We don't believe this should be disclosed. And you know how we're going to control the entire matter? Next time you come up as far as budget requirements and requests,
mm-hmm,
we're going to remember how you played ball with us.
Right, sure.
And so if it was the Navy calling the shots, yes, then I would like to believe, and I would say 50-50, that there's a chance that there could be a break towards the disclosure. But whenever the politicians get involved, I'm sorry, they only look out for themselves. Right. They're in a perpetual campaign mode. They're always in this re-election as far as position of what influences the public in getting them reelected the most.
Right.
At some point, they may decide that, well, disclosure gets them reelected.
Right.
Maybe the president gets me reelected. But if there's a concern that it panics the people, if the culture shock is enough to disrupt the apple cart, so to speak, and throw everything in the turmoil, then who's going to make that announcement? Right. Who's going to say, you know, we have no control over, you know, this phenomenon, but vote for me come next election, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. I know that many politicians have dangled it like fruit, you know, in front of the donkey kind of thing. You know, it's like, oh, well, if I get in, we're going for disclosure. And
as Jimmy Carter did.
Yeah.
President Carter, you know, before being elected president, I'm going to release the files.
Yeah. Oh, Bill Clinton did. Yeah.
What stopped him?
Yeah, somebody did.
Somebody did, exactly. Yep. Somebody did.
Yeah.
And that's another investigation, and that's another show, because we have a lot of ideas, and we're getting close to believing who those somebodies are.
Right. Mm.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you about that, because I think you might have referred to it in a recent post of yours on your Facebook page, but I'll leave it there until we talk. But
until the next time.
Yes.
Excellent.
Now, we will
do it next time.
Oh, very good. Thank you so much for that. And we got just a couple minutes left. I want you to definitely have a chance to let people know how to keep in touch with what you're doing, how to follow your work, et cetera, et cetera.
Definitely.
Certainly. Our website is www.roswellinvestigator.com. And our latest book, UFO Secrets, Inside Wright Patterson, is just out within the last month. It already went bestseller at Amazon. It's also available at Barnes & Noble and certainly all fine bookstores throughout the country. And we already have another book coming out for next year, and we're ready, gearing up to start working on another book, unrelated to Roswell, but still part of the growing interest in the UFO phenomenon. There's a whole new generation of people that aren't into the history, and you know you need to know the history to know where we're going.
Right,
and then you realize that the reason behind the cover up is twofold. It's still a cover-up of ignorance that after all these years, they still don't know from where, from why, and from who. And as I like to say, they still can't find the on button.
Right.
So we're all part of the same mystery in that regard.
All right. There we go.
Wonderful, sir. And thank you so much for your time tonight. I can't thank you enough for being here. And everybody, we will do our best to get Don back on the show to continue this dialogue.
Brent, Don, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Oh, thank you so much, sir. All right, everybody. Have a great night. We love you all. Be good. Be kind. Be nice. Take care of each other. Help each other out. Find the magic in every day. And remember to laugh as much as you can. Good night, everybody.
betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Barton, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.